Thanks, Eric. Morning, all. You're very welcome to the programme. Between now and nine, a yellow glen and a yellow ben in County Mayo. Who gets the gold in the Kerry deal? And a lifetime of training yields a winner at 70 in Cork. Do you know, I suspect that the story is about to change for everyone who is working outside at the moment. This may be the last programme of this year with an autumnal vibe to it, because winter is coming, my friends. You hear an awful lot about the damage that farming does to the environment. You hear a lot less about the things that a lot of farmers are doing that protect and even enhance nature, which is a pity because we all respond much better to positive examples than telling off. And there is a scheme which for 6 years now has been shining a light on those farms and farmers who have taken steps to farm in ways that don't do damage. You'll have heard a fair few Farming for Nature ambassadors on Countrywide sharing their approach in the past, but now all of that wisdom has been gathered together in a handbook, a book written by farmers for other farmers. On Glanbui Farm near Knock in Mayo, I talked to dairy farmer Sinead Moran, one of the scheme's ambassadors, about what she had learned and how Farming for Nature had helped her business. That is the sound of bovine bliss. One of Sinead's short-horned dairy cows with her face firmly planted in the silage cut on Glanbui Farm's 34 acres.
So every field has a name. Some of them are brilliant, some of them are really just lazy. This is the meadow field because it comes up in a beautiful meadow. That field that you can see there is the original Glanbui, what we're named after. And the next field is called the field beside the road. So it's really original.
Walking the land, we get right down into what others might think of as the weeds.
Which is this little plant here, and that's its stem. Ribworth planting. It is, on the science front, it's a grass herb. It's a natural anti-wormer. It's also really high protein. And in New Zealand, they've tried it where they've planted it back in with monocrops of Italian ryegrass, and they've been able to reduce the ammonia emissions in cow's urine. It is the most amazing little plant. On top of that, you can eat it yourself. We can also make a salve out of it. If first kind of sun that comes out in this high summer, I'd always get a little bit of a rash. Take this down, blitz it, rub it on, sort it.
And besides all of that, your cows like it.
Besides all of that, the cows like it. And you see it now when we go back down to the shed, you see it in the silage and it's like this black, it just comes this black, but it's really high protein. Like they reckon that protein can be up on 17-18% in this little grass herb.
And you never added that, did
we
you?
We never added that.
Just,
that
it was here all the time.
Totally natural to grow in fields on the side of roads. It's deemed a weed and it is the most fantastic plant. Like every year I do a post on our social media about 10 things I love about planting because I'm constantly learning new things. Like when you used to be able to collect the seeds and you can ground the seed for a flower.
Really?
God. It is the most amazing plant.
So everything from skin treatments
to natural anti-wormer to high protein for the cows to reduce an ammonia in their urine. The other thing is they have a bit of a taproot, so they're reaching down past the grass. Like you can see even where it grows, you'll tend to see tufts of good grass growth around it. So yeah, it's an amazing plant.
And there again is the evidence. Silage that not only goes down a treat, but generates the kind of milk solids that make for a unique product. Each field producing noticeably different cream and butter.
Because it's quite a sandy base, on the steep hill there you get a lot of birdfoot, which is again, fixes nitrogen. You'll get kind of the first leaves of the clovers coming up, dandelions, you know, and I remember a conventional farmer telling me that his grandfather used to call the dandelions the dairyman's gold. So it's ironic that it's deemed a weed.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And of course, like the more greenery, the more diversity the cows eat, depending on which field they're in, totally impacts the cream and then impacts the butter.
I wonder if you did think about using Dairyman's Gold as the brand, would you run into copyright issues there?
I wonder. Can you imagine a sign up beside the sign of how to manage weeds? Yeah, it would be a nice one for sure.
Sinead and her partner MJ are taking two incomes from the kind of farm conventionally called marginal. In other hands, it might only support a part-time suckler operation. When doing something very different to everyone else around you, having the science-based seal of approval from the Farming for Nature network really mattered to Sinead.
You know, being a Farm for Nature ambassador, if you get the plaque, it's like a validation from them. You know, you're working with ecologists who know what they're talking about.
We're not just lunatic hippies.
Yeah, that they're kind of going, oh yeah, you're backing this up, you know.
There is science behind this.
Exactly,
yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, sometimes when you want to make a bigger impact and you want to reach other farmers, you know, having that science to back up what you're doing is fantastic. Then the other side of it is bringing all these farms together that are so different, from small scale to large scale to direct selling to selling into co-ops, but yet who have all managed to do something on their farm that is a benefit to nature, but at the same time has actually benefited their farm.
How much are you learning from each other?
Lots. Like, there's so many things that we've learned from a couple of the guys that are in it that would be conventional, that perhaps before might have just rolled my eyes at and not listened to. But when you see the things they're doing, you're thinking, wow, that's great. You know, I can definitely learn from that. And vice versa, where you see a lot of bigger farms looking to smaller farms and kind of going, oh, well, these guys are actually doing it as well. You know, small is not always bad. And we don't always need scale in business or in farming.
And that wouldn't have happened without that network, would it?
I think we'd still remain on the fringes for sure. I think Farming for Nature definitely brings that sense of validation, but also brings, by bringing us all together and highlighting all the different types of farms, it is a great way to show that anyone, if they choose to do something different on the farm, can do it no matter what scale.
How has it helped in explaining to the public what it is that you're doing? Like, people can look in here now, see a big corner of a field full of brambles and not automatically think, I suppose, that's lazy farming.
Yes.
Why haven't they cleared that corner out?
Yeah. I think from a customer perspective, it helps. As in, number one with customers is communication from us, if that makes sense. Like, us, our direct communication with them and explaining things definitely helps. But again, having the plaque on the wall of Farming for Nature Ambassador just gives that extra kind of next step of, well, someone else also said that what they're doing is not just talking crap from their mouth, basically, that they are doing something of a benefit. Look, it's a fantastic network. And now with the book coming out, like, the book is just going to take all that knowledge from all those different farms and put it into a really simple format for another farmer to pick up and say, God, I might try that. You know, even their section on what we deem noxious weeds and how do we manage them. So our thistles, our ragworts, things like that, that we don't necessarily have to go in there and spray, but maybe there's a different management system that we can take either through grazing or topping or something else that will reduce the problem, but also kind of leave space for nature, if that makes sense. So, yeah.
Sinead Moran there, Glanbuie Farm near Knock, County Mayo. And as we speak, the presses are rolling on that brand new Farming for Nature handbook, which is going to be available from next week. It is a very, very handsome looking product with lots of ideas on how to manage a farm for nature, lots of insights from Farming for Nature ambassadors, lots of science to explain how all of it works, all beautifully illustrated with some very, very familiar names to you. The authors are Emma Hart, Brendan Dunford, and the Farming for Nature project leader, Bridget Barry, who joins me from Cork this morning. Bridget, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Philip.
You've become a very influential voice in farming in a relatively short space of time. Remind me where the idea came from.
Yeah, so the network has come so influential. So Farming for Nature was born out of the work that had happened in the Burren for the previous 30 years. I was up there and I was managing the Burren Bio Trust, which is an education conservation charity up there. And it's the sister charity to the Burn Life Programme. And I remember the conversation where Brendan and I were sitting down and we were talking about one of our big successes was when you awarded the Burn farmers, you know, the ones who got the best biodiversity that year, their sense of pride and the power that they held to be able to encourage their peers to make changes was phenomenal. And we were just wondering whether we could do this nationally, whether we could change the narrative that farming and nature are apart from each other. And actually, there's so many farmers that are doing good stuff on the ground, and whether they could be pulled out and be used as spokespersons for nature. So we set up the Farming for Nature Ambassador Awards, and in the first year we put out to different organisations like the National Parks Wildlife Service and the Department of Ag and various other organisations to put forward the farmer that they thought throughout Ireland that was doing great stuff for nature. And I think in that first year we got about 30 nominees, and we selected 6 Farming for Nature ambassadors. And we had an awards and it was all great, but we suddenly realised actually we needed to get their voice out there more.
And how many do you have now?
So we actually have 104 Farming for Nature ambassadors. So,
and I think the point of them is that they're big and they're small. They're intensive, extensive, highlands, lowlands, dairy, beef, horticulture, sheep, poultry. There is a sort of a role model there for everyone. But if the idea is for some of Ireland's 137,000 other farmers to copy them, can you quantify how successful you've been yet?
I suppose we could quantify in numbers. You know, I can throw stats at you like, you know, we have 12,000 subscribers to our newsletter. We have 24,000 followers on Instagram, you know, on our different social medias. You know, lots of 4,000 people have come on our farm walks. There's lots of numbers out there that I could throw at you. But actually, the bit that really gets me, Philip, is when people take the effort to write to us and to email us and say, listen, I looked at your video or listened to that podcast, and I've made these small changes on my farm, and it has blown my mind how nature has come back. And that's harder to quantify because it's, you know, it's anecdotal, but that's that the fact that people actually regularly take the time to write to us and say that Farming for Nature has changed the way they farm.
Do you know what else comes through the handbook, though, and the testimonies of the individual farmers, is that this is not just about farming for nature, it's also about farming for yourself. Taking the foot off the accelerator a little bit can make a very significant impact to a farmer's life.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I mean, I think farmers are so busy and so busy looking at the bottom line that very often they forget to look around at the benefits that nature can hold for them. I mean, I was speaking to a dairy farmer the other day, and he was saying he put in the measures for acres. You know, he brought out the fences from the hedgerows, he fenced off around the riparian zones, and he planted hedgerows. But what really surprised him, he said, is how much he actually enjoyed his farm more, how much he now took the time to stop at those hedgerows, see what was coming out, see what birds were going into the hedgerows. And he said for him, it gave him a sense of calm in the chaotic world that he felt he was dealing with in terms of dairy farming.
Who is the book written for? Who do you hope will read it?
I suppose it's for anyone interested in farming or growing. I mean, it's for the big farmer who's trying to look at how they can be more resilient to climate changes. It's for someone who's looking to grow more nutrient-dense food, or it's even for the gardener who wants to plant more, you know, pollinator-friendly flowers in their garden. I suppose the idea is that it would stimulate people to take action, you know, to start somewhere small. And these small measures can make a massive difference for nature. So it doesn't have to be complicated, but that everyone can do something small or big for nature on the land that they own.
Okay. You're doing advanced sales, farmingfornature.ie?
Yes, absolutely. So we have pre-orders. Anyone can order from now. Like you say, it's hot off. It's coming off the press in a couple of weeks' time.
It'll still be a little bit inky now, yeah.
Yeah. But so it's available to buy now, and you can buy in bulk, or you can, you know, if you're a farm advisor or you're a bookshop, or if you're just someone.
That's very optimistic. Yeah. You can buy in bulk for everybody in your life.
Do give it to all your neighbouring farmers and continue with the movements. Join us in the movement. But it's, I think the reason behind the book, Philip, is that, you know, there's a lot of digital overload out there. There's a lot of information out there. But nothing beats a physical book, something in your hand that you can have in your Jeep, in your tractor, up on the shelf, you know. And I think the important thing about this book is it's written, there's 50 anecdotes from farmers, but it's also backed up by science. Dr. Emma Hart helped us doing phenomenal work, making sure that everything that was put in the book was backed up by science. The bibliography is over 500 papers, so fair dues to her for going through all of them. Yeah. But what's really nice is that each habitat, so whether it's soil, grasslands, woodlands, whatever it is, 5 simple tips. You can look at the 5 simple tips, and then under each tip, there's actions you can take. So you can take further action. So whether even you just want to dip into it over a cup of coffee in the morning, or whether you want to kind of, you know, really explore it in great detail when you have time, I feel it's going to be the reference book on your shelf for a long, long time.
Bridget Barry, thank you very much for joining us with that this morning. Now, just before I leave this, one of the familiar contributors in the Farming for Nature handbook is Jane Clark. Jane is the poet who grew up on a farm in Roscommon. Farming and nature are woven right the way throughout her work, as with this poem, which features in the book. This is The Caddisfly.
At the edge of a winter field, a farmer steps into the stream that chitters and chatters downhill from Devil's Bit western slopes. He scoops up a handful of water and praises the mystery of microbes. He turns over rocks as if panning for gold, whoops when he finds a caddisfly's tubular home. Green, brown, yellow and red, grains of sand and tiny pebbles bound together with a silken thread.
Poetry, science, nature, farming, ambassadors, where else would you get it? The Farming for Nature handbook, available in the next couple of weeks, farmingfornature.ie for more information on that. Who is getting the gold in the Kerry deal after this break?
Email countrywide@rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run?
If you're older than you want to admit to, you will remember that as the theme tune to the 70s sitcom Dad's Army. We had an equivalent of the Home Guard throughout the emergency, manning observation posts around the coast, known in some places not as Dad's Army, but as the Seagulls or the Seagulls. There were 83 watch stations on cliffs and mountaintops around the country, each with its own numbered ERA sign visible from the sky. And Lorna Siggins hiked up to ERA 63 on Binbui in County Mayo, with Vincent McGrath pointing out the landmarks to her.
Now, you're looking out at the Stocky. The Stocky are 1.6 billion years old.
The stags?
Yeah. The stags. The stags brought here. Now, Tom, would you like number 63?
Now we're at ERA. Right. So could you tell me how they constructed this? They got these white quartz stones.
Yes, and as Jimmy McGrath, or Seamus Jamesy as he was called here in his day, my uncle, they gathered them from where we were started out at the new pier, along the shore all the way back as far as the little bridge, and they brought them out here on the donkeys, and they constructed number 63 of 82, because they started in County Louth and went all around the coast, and this is number 63, and you have 64 on Downpatrick Head.
Right.
And ERA was quarried from, there's a few little quarries out here where they actually quarried the stone, and that brought some of it from the shore as well, like
right.
On the donkeys. We put the ephod on ERA as well.
Oh, the fada!
Which I didn't see in some of the other ones that I was
Did
at.
Did the others have a fada on the
I didn't see a fada on a few more than...
Perfection. But I suppose that's what the ERA 63
sign. Was about.
Yes. That was for the Allies, I presume.
Or was it for everybody who knew that Ireland was a neutral country? I think that was the whole idea of that.
Local school teacher Breedy Shine, her grandfather Charlie Doherty had been a coast watcher.
The British, or I suppose the Allies, but they would have been the British, would have been flying over towards the Atlantic where there was some battles going on. And they made a secret deal with our government that they could fly across that little corridor and across Donegal Bay because it was quicker. I presume.
And that's what made this lookout post very important.
Because we're on that headland, we're on the edge of that corridor. So there would be a number of lookout posts along the north coast of Mayo, Dún Vriste near Ballycastle, and then along on the coast. But ours would have been the last one on the furthest point. So that's what made it so important. And that's why the sightings of so many airplanes and boats as well was so plentiful.
There's a lot of entries, isn't there?
There is, huge amount, and that's what makes it really, really interesting for people.
Seaplanes and submarines. And so at some point, I suppose the idea is that there'll be a trail
It would be lovely. And it would be lovely for every community to kind of gather their own little history about their own one, you know, because we have ours from our families and from the people around. But you can be sure that every single lookout post has the same.
That's right.
And it would be lovely, for especially for our young people, you know, to know what happened, what's that little tower for, you know.
And go in to see inside. It looks like the wheat house of the boat.
Right. So we go in now and have a look.
It is like a wheelhouse.
Six windows.
Yeah, the phone was here.
Oh, the phone was there,
yes.
In the wall.
The little fireplace was here.
So from here you can see Onchaileach.
Onchaileach, and Stockley.
The Stags of Broadhaven.
Yeah, and then on a clearer day you can see over as far as Belgerry.
And they had the binoculars and a compass, and they could see for...
They said that they could see for 17 miles. Out to sea, and they could look for over as far as Downpatrick Head, which they said was 17 Irish miles, 440 yards longer than an English mile.
I suppose they had some sort of little desk for the logbooks then, did they?
Oh, they had a little desk here.
Under this last window.
Just a small desk.
So what's that, next stop, Iceland?
Iceland, yes, that would be the next stop from here, northwest of here.
It's a stunning view, but at the same time, if you had to be standing here all day looking at it...
For
12 hours.
And they didn't miss anything, because from the logbooks, as you can see, they had everything covered. Mm. In fairness, they did a great job. When they started out, after a while, they did a bit of training and everything got better. The handwriting got better, the note-taking got better, and they were able to actually recognise the planes and the ships and the flags for communication. They were known as the Seagulls, because they were up here high over the sea.
So well, when they spotted the Catalina seaplanes, which were searching for the German battleship Bismarck, they were recorded at all the lookout posts.
Yes. Time distances between lookout posts were very accurate. They did a great job.
You didn't put down the fire, and you knew
I was waiting for you actually to do it. I thought you'd have been up here
with
the kettle on and everything.
On the night of the 21st of October, 2014, there was a severe storm that night. So when people woke up the following morning and they looked out at the headland, they realised straight away something was missing. And what was missing was Jackie Watch. It had been flattened completely to the ground, just like a deck of cards, it had fallen completely. And then it was after that, people made efforts to try and have it rebuilt. But it took a while to get the necessary assistance. And really, without the help of the Air Corps, we wouldn't have been able to do it. And then, of course, the Rural Social Scheme. They did all the work on the building.
So how many of you worked on it, Micheál?
Eddie Ginty, Philip, Michael Burke, Parik, and I.
There was eight. There's eight in the portrait.
Oh, there is, yeah.
Melvin as well came out.
Melvin is right,
Melvin Tide and Seamus O'Malley.
Yeah.
They came after Micheál.
Yes, yeah.
Well, wasn't it great that it was local people that rebuilt it?
Yeah.
Absolutely
wonderful.
Michael Garving, Endon Report by Lorna Siggins, where you also heard Thrasa Ní Gearrí and Bríd Ní Shine as well. 0870 32 32 32 is the WhatsApp number. Miriam says, please repeat the name of the weed discussed at the beginning of the programme. Is it a plant? Is it a weed? It's called ribwort plantain. What it is very much in the eye of the beholder. 0870 32 32 32. If you are making a Charleville cheddar cheese sandwich with Dairy Gold spreadable butter today, you might recognise those as things made by the Kerry Group. If you're eating something that has been flavoured with smoke, breaded or battered, or a coffee flavoured with a syrup, chances are you're also consuming something made by the Kerry Group. And these very different aspects to the same company is behind Kerry asking its shareholders, can it sell off most of its dairy business, please? It's a big change, which has potentially big knock-ons for farming. Cue Lorcan Roach Kelly to walk into the studio, agribusiness editor with the Irish Farmers Journal, a man with his nose in the spreadsheets of all of the milk processors. Very good morning to you, Lorcan.
Good morning, Philip.
Why would Kerry want to disentangle itself from Kerry Dairy? Isn't that where it all began?
I suppose A history lesson is probably the best place to begin with this story. Like, if we look at the history of Kerry from 1974, it started out as a dairy co-op. There was some government involvement at the time, but in the early mid-80s, Kerry decided to expand and needed to raise capital, so it floated on the stock exchange as a PLC. There was quite a few co-ops did that at the time. We saw Waterford did the same thing and a few others. But what Kerry did, it went on an acquisition spree and it started buying companies that weren't dairy companies but were kind of a dairy adjacent, I suppose you'd call them. They were buying companies that were involved in nutrition, they were involved in flavourings, were involved in that. And that business between the mid-80s and right up to today has really taken off for Kerry. So Kerry Group, as we see it right now, is by turn
It's
up,
everything. It's it, everything. Look at the website. It reaches its tendrils into pretty much everything you put into your mouth.
Absolutely. And also it's like its business is 90% non-dairy. So 10% of the 10% of the turnover is dairy. When it comes to the profits, the vast majority of profits Kerry make is from the non-dairy business. The dairy business is always everywhere. It's okay. A small margin business.
So no doubt that's where its focus is. Might it also feel a little bit unseemly for a company with such global ambitions to be involved in local rows about the price of milk?
Oh, there's always going to be local rows about the price of milk, no matter who. But I think it's just its focus now is on the ingredient side of business. So the I suppose for Kerry Group, the dairy business is seen as a legacy business. It's kind of like, you know, when you leave home, I suppose, like when you go home and look at the toys you had when you were a kid or used to play with them. So Kerry's kind of like that with the dairy business.
The band hasn't broken up, though, so to speak. They are still going to perform on each other's solo albums. They're not completely separated.
They're not. Like the deal that was, I suppose, put forward the other day was that Kerry Group and Kerry Co-op would have a joint venture, is what they're going to. So basically, Kerry Co-op will come up with 350 million euros. Kerry Group will hold on to 150 million euros, so 70-30. And then over the next decade, Kerry Co-op will buy the balance, the extra 150 million, back off Kerry between now and 2035. And if they can't buy it by 2030, Kerry Group will lend them the money to buy it back off them. So it's very much Kerry Group want to get rid of this. So Okay. They're breaking up. It's a slow breakup, but the die is cast as the direction they're going to take on it.
Average payout to shareholders?
Well, average shareholders, like the Kerry Co-op shareholders own 11% of Kerry Group. So you look at 11% of Kerry Group right now is worth about 1.7 billion euros. There's 11,900 shareholders. So they're looking at their value of the shareholding is in around 145,000 euros each. Under the deal as is proposed, they'll get 85% of their co-op shareholding in Kerry PLC shares, worth about 122,000 to 125,000 euros, depending on where Kerry is trading in the market today. And then the other 15% will go into a fund to buy the dairy operations.
Back to unseemly local rows about the price of milk. Will the dairy business going to Kerry Dairy and in the hands of the management hands of a company that's a little bit closer to the farmers mean that the farmers are likely to get any more leverage over the price?
I'm not sure that it'll get any more leverage over the price. They will continue to argue with the price, but some of the debt and stuff that's coming with this, because Kerry Co-op will owe 150 million euros in debt that has to be paid off, they'll also have an outstanding balance that'll have to come up with they'll owe 100 million and need another 150 million to come up with in the next few years. So there will be debt to pay off. As part of this deal as well, Kerry Group is getting an annual dividend of 7.5 million euros from the dairy operation, as long as they're part of the joint venture. So there will be some headwinds there when it comes to paying a better price milk, but it comes down to how much you can sell the product for at the end. So if they have some good, as you said, some good consumer products that are coming with it, if those consumer products continue to perform well, the company should be profitable and there should be more money there for farmers.
Speaking of headwinds now, is there enough milk in the country? Is there going to be enough milk in the country in coming years to keep the lights on in all of these bright, shiny new processing plants?
Yeah, I think this is kind of one of the really big issues facing the dairy industry in Ireland. We saw last week, a merge between two of the smaller co-ops, Tipperary and Narrabourne, and that was driven much by, I suppose, the expansion that happened in Tipperary, particularly in the last few years, that was looking for a continued expansion in the milk supply in Ireland. The milk supply in Ireland stopped growing in 2022. That was the peak year, 2023. Mixture of weather, mixture of costs, the milk supply fell to about 5%. This year it looks like be back another 2 or 3% by the time the year ends out. So we've seen milk supply fall. And if you're looking at nearly 900 billion litres of milk produced here in 2022, if we fall back to 8 billion litres, then we're seeing a huge drop of 1 billion litres. That's a large co-op of milk supply that's been left the system. So a lot of the investments that happened over the last 5 or 6 years, that were driven by the end of quotas. So the production ramped up, producer said, we'll build a new dryer, we'll take all that milk, you'll be fine. And I saw someone recently said to me, some of the investments were a bit like a guy with 15 cows building a brand new milking parlour. So it's never going to pay for itself unless things everything went right. And things haven't necessarily gone right.
I have to mention the D word here. If the derogation is cut or yes. lost, how much less milk are we looking at then? How many less cows?
We're looking at least 10%, another 10%, because we could lose another 1 billion litres. We could be down to 7, which we're kind of getting close to where we were then back in 2015, before a lot of this new production came online.
All right, that suggests to me that then one of two things happens if the derogation goes. You will either end up with a price war as they all start competing for what milk there is available in the market, or perhaps they enter into some form of cooperation with each other, or in the form of mergers like we saw last week.
Yeah, I think like some of the, a lot of the co-ops need to almost look, be more cooperative with each other. We have Ornua, which is the umbrella co-op for all the co-ops that sell the Kerrygold brand we're all familiar with. But we could see that there's a lot of production facilities in the country, and there should be a way of kind of maximising the use of these facilities. Some of the older facilities might need to be retired. Some of the co-ops might need to be smaller. Some of the co-ops might end up being, I suppose, what they'd call a supplier co-op. So rather than having their own production facilities, they would just supply milk to another.
But this is Lorcan Roach Kelly speculating about what needs to be done. Is there any evidence that there is plan B planning going on between the cooperatives in the event of the derogation being cut?
Not that I've seen a plan B. Like, I think what we saw, particularly with the Tipperary Arabon deal recently, was that was deal was where Tipperary wanted to stay independent as long as it could. And we're seeing that kind of a very much a cooperative attitude. We are our own co-op, we are loyal to our own brand for the farmer side as well. But there comes a point where that's not viable anymore. And the problem is, if you get to the point where you're not viable, you're having these kind of mergers in situations where it's a merger of weakness. What you should have in the industry is an industry that's willing to say, okay, here's the problem we're going to face. How are we going to deal? Can we get a plan in place? Here's what the plan is. And then you don't have this kind of crunch point where everyone's panicking to try and get a deal over the line.
But it does mean that post-2026, there is the possibility of the weaker operations going to the wall and maybe parts of the country ending up critically underserved by processing, and people have to ship their milk all over the place.
Well, I suppose that's always the way these things, like we get the, it's a very typical business cycle, isn't it? Like you get a growth somewhere in a cycle, investment happens, overinvestment happens, and then the assets that were invested in are worth less money, are underused.
Okay, but the difference here is that Brussels has been sending us clear market signals for a while. In fact, the commissioner came here and said, Ireland, you've been using your time very badly.
Yeah, well, I think if you look at it from the farmer perspective, one thing we have seen, and perhaps like the one of the reasons that we haven't seen an expansion in dairy in the last 2 years is because farmers are looking at this and saying, hang on, I'm not going to take a 5-year bet on my milk production if I'm going to get cut in 2 years' time.
And so the farmers are being prudent. It's the politicians and the CEOs that you have to wonder about.
Well, there's an election coming up, in case you didn't know. So
oh, really? Okay.
It's probably not going to turn around and tell farmers, well, actually, in fairness, the Social Democrats have said we're not going to protect the derogation. But beyond them, there haven't been many people that have come out and said we're not, because it's a promise they don't want. They want the promise, we will fight for the derogation. And that's easy to say. Everyone's going to say they'll fight for the derogation. But like, unless someone says,
will they win it?
Exactly. So until that fight is won, we're not going to know which way it's going to roll.
Lorcan Roach Kelly, agribusiness editor of the Farmers Journal, thank you very much for coming into us as always. Well, Fairy House on Tuesday produced a gem of a story. A 70-year-old trainer, Eleanor Broderick, saddled her first ever winner on the track. Liz Lelad, whose yard name is Dante, romped home 6.5 lengths clear in the Hunter's Chase. Joy unbounded in the Broderick yard after so many years of both riding and training. Well, Brenda Donoghue visited her in the yard in Fermoy, where she also met Eleanor's partner, Matt Slattery. And because this country is still essentially a village, it turns out that Brenda and Eleanor had met many years ago through, of all things, a Riverdance phone-in competition.
Oh no, behave, please. You're going to be on the radio, you know. He's a lovely horse. See that eye? That's a bright eye now. How we know horses are well in themselves is the eye tells it all. If you come out first thing in the morning and their heads are out over the door, their heads are out over the door and they have a bright eye and they ate up, you know then you have a healthy horse.
Eleanor, what a week you've had. And we're here with Lisley Ladd. Tell me a little bit about his features.
You have to go back down to the grassroots of breeding. They say it's 80% the mare,
and 20% the deli, the sire. He's just nice. He's nice. Yeah. He's a beautiful looking horse. He's by a horse called Dansant. So the Dante came from Dansant. And he's my mammy's baby's present. And she's 19. And I still have her, and she's a smashing mare.
Coming to the second last, and it's Ballyphillip coming there on the outside, squeezing through in between the leading pair, is Leslie Ladd on the left.
Eleanor, Fairy House was magic for you. You won your very first inside the rails race with Dante here.
Stop. Yeah.
Tell me, what did it feel like when you saw that he was actually winning?
Well, first of all, I'm deadly, right, because my heart comes out my mouth. I get terribly nervous when they're running, right? So I stayed on my own. Matt and anyone that was with us just went away, my girl, and they just went up in the stand. But I was watching the big screen. And every time he came to a fence, I went, don't fall. And I was walking around. Jesus Christ, I was up to 90. But anyway, I knew coming to the last, I knew he wouldn't be beaten. I knew going around, he was pulling like a train. Like, he was loving every minute of it. He's striding out, loved the ground and loved every minute of it. Mm. And I knew, and when he came in, when he passed the post in, I went, oh my, at least I didn't curse this time, Brenda. Mm. I went, oh my God, that didn't happen.
Anymore, the final fence, Leslie Ladd, and down is Ballyphillip, leaving Leslie Ladd and Owen O'Brien way out in front on the rod end. Leslie Ladd winning clearly for owner-trainer Eleanor Broderick.
And the rest was like just a fog. Like, everyone came around us and we got a rug, we got the best turned out. I got a beautiful trophy. Oh my God, my father would have loved it if he was alive. I have to go back now again because I must put the rug on him.
I'll follow you.
I was watching this fella one day in the yard last year, and whatever kind of frightened him, he flattened me. Mm. You know, and but that's part and parcel of the whole thing. Do you know, I broke every bone in my body, bar my nose and my collarbone.
Have you?
And horses. I have, yeah. I broke my back and everything. Well,
did you?
I did. Broke my two arms of ponies. Broke my back, fell, broke my shoulder. The only thing I didn't break riding was my femur. I broke that skiing. We need to take him out. He wants to go out.
What I'm trying to get a sense of is nearly 71. Not that almost. I want to hammer age or whatever.
No, I don't mind a bit. Jesus. Yeah. I don't mind about it. I still have all my faculties and everything, so it is grand.
Did you ever think that this was actually going to happen in your life?
No, I dreamt it. I dreamt about it all the time. And I know, you know, I have won Pointy Points, but like, this is a big deal for me, especially Fairy House, the home of National Hunt Racing. Mm. I don't win in places like that, small people like me. And the amount of good wishes and goodwill I got after it, and from people I knew, people I didn't know, we want more people like he in this business. That's our paddock now. They go out there now for a last day. Now he's rolling, look. That's a great sign of a horse, to see a horse rolling, going down the ground and rolling. That's their bath. You see, you have to have a great eye for this kind of thing. And we have.
You talked about this week was your team, your riders,
and of
course your partner, Matt.
Yeah.
Hello, Matt.
Hello, how are you?
How are you?
Good.
How long are you together? And sometimes in life, you don't get that second chance at finding romance and love and companionship. Can you tell me a little bit about how that came about?
Do you want to do it or will I do it?
Matt,
come back here now. Come back here. Don't be shy. Listen, we met. He came to give me a hand on the farm, as I said, when I was on my own. You know, he was working with me and whatever. And then I had my 50th birthday, and on Christmas Eve that year, it just happened. And that's 21 years ago now. Next Christmas Eve.
And Matt, have you anything you remember about that Christmas Eve that you can share?
I had black hair coming and I'm gone white now.
See, he had a red coat on. I remember when I met him in the pub and he had this red jacket on. I said, where did you get that jacket? Oh, he said, that's my son Michael's. And then we were walking up along from the pub to here and he decided to take on a little small hedge, you know, jumper on the way up.
Sure, he was in love. He was a young fella. He was full of it all.
Ah, yeah. Well, anyway, I don't know. But anyway, look, I don't think I'd have this place here. I think it'd be sold if he hadn't come in and given me a hand when he did. Mm. I was on my own and I wasn't trusting anyone really. Mm. Do you know? I mean, I was going out on dates and things, but it wasn't the same thing. But I don't know. We just clicked. And like, we have the same interest. See, we're both horses and cattle and everything, you know?
Yeah.
Like, this is a farm. And there's a lot of cattle here, and we've reared a lot of cattle here and reared calves and everything here. And he drives the tractor, I don't. He drags, tears and drags, and we're putting up another shed there now for another couple of stables and that for the horses outside. And, you know, so it wouldn't be what it is today only for him.
And Matt, I have a worry. She's only after you for your labouring skills.
I'd say you're right. Yeah. It'll work out, Harry. Don't worry about it.
Did you find it was nice to find a partner again?
Oh, I suppose it was, yeah. Like, we'll probably find one somehow, instead of looking to find herself. She put up with me for a good bit.
And he put up with me. Like, we do row now, you know, yeah. And we do have arguments. Yeah. Mother of God Almighty, yeah. You should hear us sometimes. We're like dishwashers.
Listen, what plans have you got for her 71st birthday?
No. Oh, very little.
Excuse me now, I have a restaurant booked where he's taking me out on a date night. Hello.
News to me.
No, it isn't. I told you it was booked.
When you were a young girl and you were a jockey, what were your ambitions?
I went from ponies and I went from ponies straight to race horses. I said to Dad, I said, I'd love to go point to pointing. You know, I want to do the fences. I want to go 30 miles an hour over these fences, you know. Yeah. Always dreamt of going maybe to the Grand National, one of those. You know, all young people have those kind of dreams. So we got our first mare and she was Baobab, and I started riding in point to points. I had to learn it as I went along. It started there. So my first race was in a place called Killa. We were flying anyway, and the fences were plastic fences that time. It wasn't birch like it is now. And we'd no back protectors, only an old helmet on our head. And away we went anyway. And I remember we were going around the last time, and I went, God, I have no idea how far more we have to go. And I saw them all going up a hill, and I went, oh, Jesus Christ, they're finishing. I better go quick. And I finished fourth. Mother of God Almighty. Now, Brenda, yeah. I think it's time we went in and had a cup of tea after all this.
I think so, yes.
My horses are out in the field, happy out. Everything is out. We've the stables done, everything done, and I think it's time. Come on now, let's go in and have a cup of tea.
Yeah, will you ever, thank you, but will you ever forget this week?
No. No. And I'm going to collect every little newspaper article and put it all into, I have a scrapbook, and I put everything in there, and the card, the race card, the photograph, see what I'm going to put up on the wall and everything. No, I won't forget this. I never forget a win. This is so special to me because, first of all, I never thought I'd get to this stage. And secondly, look, I don't know how long I'm going to live. I mean, I'm 71, and to have achieved this at 71 is fantastic for me. It's a lifetime ambition, which I achieved, and I'm delighted.
What was it that first attracted you to the tractor driver match made in cows and horses? Eleanor Broderick there. Congratulations, Eleanor. Well done. Congratulations, Listley Lad as well. And to all the connections in the yard in Fermoy. That is all that we have time for today. This morning, Countrywide was by Mark McGrath, out of Amandine Paso Devine, owned, trained and ridden by none other than Brenda Donoghue as well. A welcome return for Sinead Mooney on Playback after the news at 9 o'clock. Don't forget, Ear to the Ground on telly on Thursday evening at 7 o'clock. But from all of us on Countrywide, until next week, have a good weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.